All right, welcome everybody. We are joined again with Michael Wan. Michael, how's life treating you, brother?
It's certainly interesting, isn't it? I'm finding myself in very, very new situations, but then also like, you know, there's a lot of like, I've been here before, like not like, oh, I remember this dream, but it's like my internal world, like a lot of like recurring themes are coming up again. And based upon the situation and then also just like, you know, natural growth, which everyone has through experience, like I get to reexamine the same things that I looked at years ago with like a new perspective and a very heightened perspective because we're at this heightened time. And I personally find that like fat, you know, I find this like really, really exciting. You know, both for me personally and then like exciting for, you know, what's unfolding.
I think that's a healthy perspective, right? Because anxiety and excitement are the same energy. It's just which direction are you applying it? And being on the excitement tip gives you the opportunity to make certain changes that can help you and help other people. While anxiety just causes the exact opposite of restriction and paralysis. So it sounds like you're on the good side of it all.
Well, I mean, that's definitely one of my hot buttons is like this reinterpreting like internal feelings with definitions. Like, you know, you feel a certain way, you get butterflies in your stomach or whatever, like, you know, whatever your physical responses are to like, let's say, and as you said, like an exciting / anxious environment. And then like kind of redefining what those feelings are. And like one of the things which I've been playing with and recognizing is like a lot of these feelings, which like when I say feelings, I'm not talking emotions, I'm talking like physical sensations, which we have tied to our emotions, we're defining as like, you know, something which is not serving us. And now I'm looking at a lot of this as like, you know, this is what power feels like. And we've been taught or conditioned, or maybe no one's ever showed us the truth, or maybe like part of the journey is like figuring it out for yourself. But like what we once thought of as like, you know, something I want to do away with is actually the indication of like the power and the energy, which is rising within. Like for an example, it's like, you know, I've been thinking about this, like you think about professional athletes and they are, you know, symbolically they are the peak, the physical peak of their particular pursuit. And a lot of them, like, you know, I've read interviews or heard like being mentioned, like, you know, before a game or before a fight, if you're a boxer, like, you know, just the nerves and like still vomiting before like a something that's significant. And I'm like, these guys are the best of the best. And so it's that, maybe that is like the normal feeling, like, you know, that is like what the, like stepping into the power feels like. And so by redefining like these things, which we once thought of, like, I want to avoid this. I want this to go away. You know, you got to go through a process before you can kind of like change what your approach to these feelings. But when you do that, you begin to, you know, it changes the game. You level up, I guess. Like nothing's changed other than your perspective. Just like you're saying, like what side are you on, the anxious side or the excitement side?
Mm-hmm. And that's the interesting thing is that we actually get a choice once we have that level of awareness and we can kind of choose where we want to be at with it. And I really like how you kind of, there's a couple of things that I like there. I liked how you define feeling as kind of this other thing associated with the emotion, not the emotion itself, because I'd never really framed it that way. But that makes a lot more sense in it. I think that's a powerful way to look at it, especially for somebody, for me, like I'm in recovery, right? In recovery, a large part of that is kind of identifying what I'm feeling and the emotions associated with it. But then subtracting the feeling, how I physically feel from the emotion is actually incredibly liberating in a sense, because it's like, this is just the sensation that this is causing me. What is this sensation telling me? And then how can I repurpose it into something more powerful? How can I bottle that lightning?
Definitely. I mean, and that's when, you know, to me, that's when like it gets kind of cool about looking at like your actual life, you know, whether, you know, in culture, the time we're alive and recognizing that whatever it is, which we work with, like, you know, whatever our our challenge in life, because everyone's got it, is like in that will ultimately, doesn't matter what it is, it's going to point to you to come to that same sort of like understanding the inner world and reframing what that is. Like nothing changes other than you. Mm-hmm. And then when you change, everything changes. And that's like kind of like that process. And you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to go in and I mean, it's cool if you could go somewhere, but you don't have to go to like some mountaintop in the Himalayas. You don't have to go and you just need to be able to go and get right and real with you. And then from that, everything else can come.
Dude, that's so powerful. I can go off on a whole tangent on that, but I want to get into some of these questions because I'm really curious about your answer. Because just in case anybody isn't familiar with you, a lot of the stuff that I've heard about you is on the Susquehanna River mystery, correct? And what is some of the other stuff that you're associated with? Because I don't know everything that you do entirely.
I mean, that's probably like, you know, in terms of original research, that's probably where I've had the most amount of exposure. I began talking about that like 3-4 years ago. And it began very much as a like synchro mystic / conspiracy type of unpacking of this story no one's ever heard of, like on the oldest river of the planet, how like all of the first fruits of our modern age, and that being globalism, computer technology and distribution of electricity. They all literally, their firsts happen on this first, on the oldest river, and then like tying in like all of the organizations and secret societies and people who are behind it. I'm like, oh, what's going on here? And more recently, that has evolved into, and realistically, this is always what I've been interested in, but you know, you can't really like lead with this because you need to have something grounded. And where it's leading to is looking at more so like what it is to be alive on Earth. You know, I don't know what Earth is, but like I know we're on it, or at least that's what we're calling it. And then specifically like re-looking at all of these things, just as what we're talking about, like with the inner world and like, you know, what you're feeling, like re-looking at like, well, we defined it this way, or I understand something in a certain way. And that is specifically being tied to like what we call a river, and looking at, and where I'm really focused on now is understanding or looking at like the actual physicality of what this thing is a river, and how it influences life, like in the most literal sense of like what we are experiencing, and then understanding that correlation. I mean, and to me, it's very similar to understanding the idea of what a neural pathway is in the brain. Like, you know, neural pathways being a link of neurons, and it's a certain pathway which is well established and that corresponds to feelings and behaviors and all this sort of stuff. Like, it's real, but it's not real. Like, you can't go into your head and pull out this neural pathway, but you can recognize it being this existing on a certain level of reality. And seeing how like everything in the natural world, like, you know, is not in an abstract, like spiritual way, but in a very real, tangible way, like it's affecting our lives. And as we become aware of how we work, like with like triggers and like compulsive, unaware behavior, and we're seeing how that happens and how that can be manipulated, we can see that also happening with the effects we've done on our environment, and seeing how that relates. And then like, okay, well now I can see this. Well, how can this change? Just as we're saying, like by redefining our inner world, what we think our inner world is telling us. Well, now we can redefine like what life is about, or how life unfolds on Earth. And so I've been talking a lot about that lately, you know, that, and then tying it into to really recognizing what is happening right now on this collective level on Earth, because, you know, we're all part of the same sort of you know, whatever, like all people are, we know that when people come, we've got something in common. You know, we got more in common with other people than we do with rocks. Doesn't mean we don't have anything in common with rocks. It just means like, this is like where we're most in common. And we have this like natural connectivity between us. And as when we see such a large, critical mass of humanity kind of like working with the same stuff, whether that's quarantine or protests or what have you, recognizing how, as we're becoming more awareness of both ourselves as individuals, how we relate to the outer world, what the outer world is, like this is a really interesting and exciting time of potentiality, but it's also like kind of a dangerous time. It's like, you know, giving birth. It's like during that time, there's like all of this potentiality one way or the other.
There's so many different things to talk about, like in what you just said, but I think one of the key things that I want to hit on, there's two actually. I like the river concept of reality kind of being like a river, or life in general having that flow, and how it's kind of associated with the other thing and looking at the macro and the micro, which is a representation of that specific river, then the macro concept of it, which is reality in general. The other thing, and I want to ask you more of a question on this, and I want to get into some of the your hero's journey kind of topic, like okay. stuff, 'cause I'm curious about that. But the question I want to ask is in regards to, I'm trying to think of the way to say it. So in regards to placing things in the physical world with intention, do you view that as a way of, I think you said it maybe in different words, but like reprogramming consciousness? So some of the things that they're doing on this river are intentional to shift the way that reality functions. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, totally. Like, I mean, that's why I'm saying like, this isn't abstract. This isn't like, you know, talking about ideas. Like, I'm like, this is just the way things work. And we just don't and that's what all of this research and this is like what I'm like, it starts as an idea and then you go and you test it. I'm like, wow, this seems to be the true nature of how our environment works. That's the same thing about going inside. Oh, this is the true nature of how I work. These physical feelings, they don't necessarily mean this or that, or I can overlook it. So with rivers, like what seemingly makes the most amount of sense to me right now is in the most literal sense that this thing which we're calling a current, this movement in water, and we can look back and we can look at like the history which we're told, like cultures across the globe have always recognized something more in water than our current culture. And we can kind of go in and intellectualize that away, but I'm just going to hold it in a place like, okay, maybe there's more to it. And what it is like this current is the natural unfolding of life. Life is just going to unfold and like a certain narrative. And when people become aware of that and how it works and like, you know, greater insight, they can go and influence that that unfolding of life in a certain way. There can't be total control, but there can be influence. So the analogy would be like hypnosis or like subliminals or all these sort of things. It's like by like working on these deeper levels within our consciousness, I can, you know, someone can affect you. They can affect how you actually live life on a very personal level. And when you're working at it on when I say environment, I'm not necessarily talking about like the natural environment. I'm just talking about like where we're experiencing life. When they're doing that on the fundamental level of that environment, they can influence everything that happens upon it. And then within that, there's a hierarchy of which of these flowing currents of life have greater influence, meaning that the more fundamental it is, like it influences everything that happens afterwards. It's not a competition, like better or worse. It's just like our consciousness. It's like your fundamental imprints and conditioning are like your foundational ones, which like, you know, stuff that happened to you when you were one, when you were like 6 days old, influences what then happens at 6 years and so forth. Like it builds upon it. And so by doing these firsts. And all it is a replication of what has always been done in terms of like sacrifice. The first fruits of computer technology, the first fruits of electrical, three-wired electrical distribution of globalism by putting that on the most foundational circuit, on the oldest river. Like what they're doing is it is influencing life, because it seems that there are other influences of how life unfolds on Earth. But for this particular time frame, there is we're in a time frame of new innovation. And by putting computer technology, like almost like as a filter or, you know, like a needle in acupuncture, like if you want to look at it that way, they're making innovation. You can influence that innovation is going to show itself in this realm of computer technology, whereas innovation in a general sense is just like very, very new ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I see it. And then recognizing that you could get a layered, hopefully with this recognition, then there comes to be like a new understanding of like, okay, well, this is how it works. Just like we're saying, I have a new understanding of how this feeling inside my body, this is just telling me this. I thought it meant that, but now I've got more awareness and now I have more control and more power. And so the whole river stuff, like what I really would like to inspire, because, you know, we're all figuring this out at the same time. I certainly don't have all the answers. I have ideas and observations, but like as we begin to look at things differently and give each other permission slips to be like, oh, we assume this meant that, and permission slips to look at things differently and explore without having to be experts, then we will collectively and individually discover new ways of being. That's what this period of time is really about. We are learning new ways of being. There's a certain narrative that wants your new way of being to be incredibly restrictive, but the truth is we're in a process of figuring out a new way of being, and that's the truth.
I definitely feel that. I have one question for you before we move on to this other stuff, and I'm hyper curious about what you will say. So in my understanding and studying of esotericism and symbolism and all of this stuff, water is relative to the emotions on one level. On another level, it's relative to the subconscious. And on another level, it's relative to kind of spiritual gifts or things along that line. So let me tie in this other thread too. And I've also seen that study of the one Japanese doctor who said that you can imprint consciousness on water. So would it be reasonable to assume that they might be trying to impart these ideas into this river? And then because all of the water systems of the world are somewhat connected, if I'm not mistaken, it then populates these ideas on a global scale.
That's 100% the way how I understand it. First of, as you described the different aspects of like what water represents. So if we're going to look at water as an archetype, we have to first have an understanding that words will never be able to fully describe an archetype. Like it transcends words. We need words because otherwise, but like realize that there's a limitation. But the flip side of that is like, well, that means there are many, many ways of looking at it and they're all connected. So yeah, like emotion, subconscious, like how we connect spiritual, like that's like water to me. Like, yes, it's all of those things. And these are different ways. And there's probably more, but they all exist in this kind of like fluid, watery, how I feel inside. I can't quite understand it, but I do understand it. So yes, and that's kind of the fun of working with symbols is, and even in the most literal sense, like being in water, you are symbolically in water, right? You know, everything which water represents and us recognizing how much we are water and how we connect. So there's the power of symbols to transcend words. That's the power of all types of symbols. We transcend our word definitions for what cannot truly be expressed in words. But then secondly, as you described, what is it, Dr. Emoto, I believe that's his name. Whether that's like, you know, 100% accurate or just like just an idea that sounds accurate or what have you, I don't know. But it makes sense to me. And that would be a model of understanding what's going on. I certainly don't believe everything that happened on the Susquehanna was part of this like drawn out plan. I think it's more so like a lot of it is the natural unfolding. Like this is what it means. It's like when you put this filter on, it's going to naturally happen. But that being said, so if you think about where this ancient water system begins, just like you're saying, you think about waters as a mechanism. And it's picking up everything around it, you know, energetically, the people who live there, the trees and the air and all the different things that could influence the water as it was in its natural state. And then it goes down this river, the Susquehanna, and it transitions into the Chesapeake Bay. The Chesapeake Bay and the Susquehanna River are the exact same body of water. If you go and you look at its geology, you'll see that the Chesapeake Bay was formed as the flooded valley, the lower valley of this ancient river, and it empties right into the Atlantic Ocean, like right in the border of Virginia and North Carolina. And that's where Jamestown was. That's where the birthplace of globalism occurred, the first colony, permanent colony of the British Empire in the beginning of the United States. And so this like dumps right into the Gulf Stream. You know, this current of water, you know, we're going, you know, we're looking at actual physical things that we understand, like, you know, in our rational, logical, scientific mind. And what our scientific mind does, it enables us to separate everything in order to understand it. So it's literally like this imprinted water, whatever water is, but it certainly seems like very imprintable. It then dumps into the Gulf Stream, and then it begins this circulation throughout what we think of as Earth. And then at the same time, there's this strange connection between the jet stream and the Gulf Stream. You know, one is in the air and one is in the water. And so now if you want to go and look at archetypes and symbols, you're like, we can see there's a connection between air, which is mind, communication, rational thought, and then water, which is all of the things you meant before. And they're connected, but they're not really connected. And so you can go down that path. And how I do it, at least, is like, I take it, like, I look at it very, very literally, like, okay, as I just described, but then kind of step back and be like, well, what does this represent on like this macro level of how everything is connected? And how one could influence this environment by understanding those rules and like symbolically putting the firsts on the, and they're on, here's the other thing. All of the firsts are at key geological transitions. Like, you know, they're not just like randomly on this river, and this river doesn't have a single major city upon it. That's why so many people don't know it, because it's not like, you know, populated with big cities. But in all of these key transitions are where we find these firsts. And that has always been like the modus operandi, the technique of like the ancient altar. You know, you would go in a very conspicuous place and build an altar to, you know, whatever you are asking for. You know, this is what I want more of. I'm giving you this. I'm sacrificing this to you so I can get more in return. I'm doing a human sacrifice. I'm sacrificing the first fruits of a harvest. It's the same model. You know, there's nothing new under the sun, as they tell us.
That's so fascinating, dude. I could pull on these strings with you for hours. I'm definitely going to have you on again at some point and digest more of this stuff from a different angle, because I'm blown away by it. I do want to get into some of kind of what led you to what you're doing now. And this is going to follow the hero's journey stuff. So I want to start out with the ordinary world. Like, what was life like for you as early as you can remember? Normal life? What, or like what?
So like real bio sort of stuff. Like you want that story? Like my
I
bio.
Wanna,
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to start at the beginning and kind of get to where you are now.
So, so I was born in the early 70s and I grew up in a community known as Columbia, Maryland. And Columbia, Maryland, is located between Baltimore and Washington, DC, right off of I-95. And all of these things, like all these roadways, we can look at them as like reflections of the energy current, like, you know, they're pulling stuff down. So, so I grew up there in Columbia, Maryland. Like you go and look at like Money Magazine, 100 best places in America to live, like that real mainstream list. And Columbia, Maryland's always like kind of on that list. Like it's a recognized, like, you know, gold star, grade A approved place to raise family. But when you go and you look a little bit more into the history of Columbia and like the people who are involved and how they, what they were trying to create. Columbia is really the first truly planned city. There are a couple other planned cities before Columbia, particularly following World War II, like Levittown and the Green Belts. Like these were like government sort of like fully government orchestrated techniques to like create society. But this one, Columbia is a little bit different. And before anything was ever built in Columbia, and I find this like really, really telling of what Columbia was and is about, which to me was a public-private project of social experimentation. And Columbia, Maryland, before anything had any of the construction began for like a 2-year period, experts throughout the country in the social sciences, all of the different social sciences came together and they said, okay, you've got a clean slate. How would you build your utopia? Whenever you hear utopia coming from power players. So anyway, so Columbia was kind of set like that. And particularly in the 70s and in the 80s was when Columbia was in its heyday of really trying a lot of different and like at the time cutting edge techniques to like raise human beings. And I grew up in that environment. And so I can look back right now and recognize, you know, that had to have had a very, very large impact in terms of how I was kind of raised. And, you know, I look at my life in terms of like going in and out of like all of these different systems, and particularly, you know, the systems of culture. You know, I grew up in very like well-established systems of culture. Like I didn't grow up in like some commune of like anarchists who wanted to go and create, you know, who recognize probably like everyone in the early stages of Columbia recognized that they wanted a new way of being, and they fell in, they were still part of the system and they just fell into a particular experiment which was being offered. And so, you know, I see that in my early development, but, you know, I was always kind of, like I walked an interesting line. Like I, you know, I look back and I don't know how much of this is like me creating false stories or not, but there seems to have been like a certain hand. I think all of the, all children grown up who grew up in Columbia and other cities, which were identified to be test places, there was testing which happened throughout. You know, when we do this to a group of children of this age, what happens 10 years later? And then that's looked at on a macro level, like an entire class, and then also individual level. You know, I'm open to the idea of looking at some of my memories, like, you know, I participated in those sort of experiments. And so I kind of had like this interesting life of during my you know, coming of age, my adolescence, and really my early 20s, of both being very well rewarded for being in the system. Like I was a popular kid, I had friends, like, you know, the system was giving me feedback of this is the way this is the way, you know, you want to live your life. But I was always a little bit of an oddball. You know, I was always a little bit not quite like fully ingratiated, I suppose. But it was, I think it was like in a charming way, like people found that endearing. And then right September 11th, you know, that was a major wake up call, particularly for Generation X. You know, you also have to consider like your generation. So I grew up like, you know, I was part of the generation that was hit with Scooby-Doo growing up. Like that was regular. We didn't have a lot of things to look at. So you have like four channels to look at. So whatever is available has greater impact on the consciousness versus now where there are hundreds of channels vying for the attention of kids, but you know, realistically they're all saying the same thing. That like, you know, all of that participated in the structuring of my consciousness. And then my generation was right at age 30, right at Saturn return when September 11th happened. And I was living in DC in the time, and I was going along a really good traditional career path, if you will. I always knew inside that's not what I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew it wasn't that. And then September 11th happened. It wasn't so much consciously, but it was like that was a shift. It was a shift for a lot of people, but it was a definite shift for me. And particularly it was very personal because I was living, my house was probably like 3-4 miles from the Pentagon. I can remember very clearly like all of the days afterwards. And I can remember kind of how I began changing. And so what happened for me, I used to be really, really interested in personal finance. Personal finance was like a big deal for me. I have a degree in finance. That wasn't like part of my professional career. That was more in technology. But I can remember going to the library. And when you hear the name of this book, like it just kind of makes me laugh, like this story. But there was a book which is kind of recognized in the realms of personal finances, like one of like the key books of really understanding how to manage personal financial, you know, existence. And the book was called The Richest Man in Babylon. Right? So I wanted to go and read this book, and I wanted to go to the library, and I was like, I'm going to go and read The Richest Man in Babylon. And I went to the library, and this was in Arlington, Virginia, and they didn't have the book. It was checked out. But right next to it, I remember like going to where it would be in the shelf of the library. And I just kind of scanned all of the other like personal finance books which were available at the time. And there was a book called The Tao of Money. And this was the first time, like I really was introduced to the concepts of what Taoism represents. And was grounded in financial, like in this kind of like, you know, financial system, which is like just a feedback system or a feedback loop into our current system of everything being controlled by the currency of money. But like, nonetheless, was like, you know, this was a crack. I had a crack from September 11th in my consciousness. I remember the weekend after September 11th, I think that was a Tuesday. And then that weekend, I went down and visited some friends in Richmond, and we're having a conversation about everything that happened. And I remember at the time saying to my friend, and my friend was always like a really kind of like open-minded friend. That's how I kind of like categorized him in my mind. I was like, there's something not right with how this is being presented. And I remember thinking at the time, they just keep showing over and over and over and over again the same sort of thing. And I'm like, that's not right. I don't know what's wrong with it, but I know manipulation when I see it. My friend freaked the F out. And he was like, I can't, how can you even say that? And it was like, at that point, like at least internally, I recognized like not everyone's seeing it this way. So that was my crack. I go and I'm introduced to this book or this concept of Taoism. And I can remember being in fifth grade. And I remember there was a kid who was like a bully, a kid I was afraid of, who was a couple years older than me, and he had a t-shirt on. I believe the brand was Town and Country, maybe like surfboards or maybe it was skateboards, but it was like a California brand. And I lived in the East Coast, and being young, like that was really glamorized. Like OP was a big brand then. And it had the symbol Town and Country of the yin and yang. And I remember the first time I saw that, I'm like, I don't know what that means, but I like how that makes me feel. And I remember that as a child. And then being introduced to the concepts through this book of like, just like what the Tao represents. Like, I'm not a Taoist, but like those ideas really, like, I'm like, okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. And that is really where I began to kind of like go off the rails, if you will, from like the mainstream sort of path I was on. I left shortly after that, like probably a year to the date of September 11th, so 2002. I was working for a large multinational company, and I was in their product management department, like a corporate job. I had a really good job at a young age, and I like quit that. There was like all these layoffs, and I'd never get laid off for whatever reason. I'm like, I'm just going to quit this. And I started working for an architect, you know, and I learned how to design, like, you know, by hand. But that was like, you know, my baby step of like, you know, I'm going to go and step away. And then from a couple years after that, like, you know, a whole bunch of things were happening. Me and my wife were at the time were struggling with like fertility issues and stuff like that. We're like, let's just get out of this part of the world and go to a place which was not as hectic as living in DC. And we moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. She had a connection there. Her parents lived there. She wasn't raised in Lancaster, but we were looking at places to live and that made sense. And so we moved there. And that was like the next step for me. And I kind of like flirted for a while with walking with one foot in one world. And when I mean like world, like, you know, mainstream, like values of society, to this like flirting with like other ways of seeing things and really challenging the very systems that were rewarding me, like financial systems and all this sort of stuff. And eventually, like years after that, well, probably before that, at this time is when I really made it almost a full-time job to get into everything as it relates to like alternative history, conspiracy, but then understanding subconscious, magic, esotericism, like anything I could consume, I'm like doing that. And I just started making art, like just like I started becoming very, very creative, and it came very, very naturally. And then what was a big thing for me was a trip down to Peru in 2011, right when I turned 40. And again, I was still like part of this sort of main, like this established society. And a few years after that, like, you know, I was pushed out. I was pushed out about 5 years ago. And that was just like when me and my family and my life, you know, my relationship with my then wife, like that, all of that kind of fell apart. And then that's when I really stepped into like a new sort of path. And, you know, those were very, very like inside for me, like that was a very, very difficult, like all of the other transitions, the little baby steps I made, I was always like really, really protected, if you will, like I was safe, like I didn't have to worry about security. And this is the first time I ever had to really worry about security. And that's when like the next level began for me. And maybe about a year after that, I, you know, just by the natural flowing of life, like, you know, very easily, I found myself living in this small river town on the Susquehanna River, and which is in Lancaster County where I was. It was called Marietta, Pennsylvania. And I was just kind of like, by curiosity, you know, whatever drives or triggers curiosity, I began to investigate the Susquehanna River. And prior to that, I was like art and meditate, like leading meditations and stuff like that. And then I got into this research, and then that brought me down a completely different path. And like for 5 years or 4 years, all I was doing was research and presenting the research. And really in the past year, and even more so in the past 6 months, everything, all of these different stages within my life have started to become integrated. Like, you know, the stuff I did 5 years ago, the stuff I did 10 years ago, the stuff I did 5 months ago, like seeing how it's all connected and like weaving that all together. So when when we started this conversation a little while ago and you're asking me about the river, I'm like, you know, that's really one part of it. But now I'm looking at it from this perspective, and that perspective was all fed from like where it all began for me, this like cycle back of like relooking as all things. And I very much see, you know, I don't see this unique for myself. I think this is true for all of us, particularly those who have a degree of inner awareness. And it's like, this is, you know, my hero's journey. This is what it looks like for Mike. You know, this is what it is. And if anything, like, I like to share this story because it inspires people to begin to look at themselves that way and to deconstruct their story for the purpose of like leveling up and getting out of their story.
Mm-hmm. I know for me, like putting my life through that template is incredibly empowering. And it's always interesting to hear other people's, because the moving pieces are different, but the theme overall is the same. And I'm going to ask you a couple questions about specific parts of the hero's journey, because I think that I parsed out where they connect in your story, but I'm curious about your opinion. So call to adventure for you would have been kind of after 9/11 or 9/11, that would have been kind of the wake up call.
I would say I had multiple ones. You know, it's mm-hmm. like lots of like small, like lots of the same model, which happens in shorter periods of time. And then like, you know, the same thing is happening in a greater period. So most definitely like 9/11, like, and that's a collective one. I would say that was particularly for Generation X, because that's around age 30. I would say what's happening right now for millennials, they're all around age 30 right now. Like, this is a really big wake-up call. And we're not going to see, they're not going to experience what that means for like 5-6 years. You know, it was 5 or 6 years before I really understood that. But definitely, definitely the 9/11. But the biggest one, the one where you really got to suck in your breath, you know, because the 9/11 I did not have to really face that many of like what we'll think of as survival fears, you know, when that mm-hmm. happened for me. So I would think like the call to adventure is going to be more so like when you're like, holy shit, you know, I'm stepping into something really new, and like, I've got these butterflies in my stomach, you know, and that happened to me in earnest was when, 5 years ago, when I moved out of my family structure, and when I was mm-hmm. like no longer like, you know, really, you know, I was taken care of, and to step out of that, I would say, was really the first part, the real intense time of the call to adventure. But I've had other times since then as well. Stepping into this church, I don't know if you've been following, like, you know, I've been sharing this story. I've been in this adventure as a caretaker in a vacant church for 60 days. I'm the only one who's allowed in here. I got to sleep here every night. I see that as a call to adventure as well. Not quite as extreme per se, like it's not as uncomfortable, but it's definitely like, you know, that would be a big marker in my tale.
Absolutely. It's interesting how there's lots of these different like points if you plot it out, and there's all these different mini hero's journeys and the larger hero's journey, like mm-hmm. of your whole life. So I think that's a good distinction as well. The next step is refusal to the call. Is there any point upon your journey where you kind of didn't necessarily want to move forward, where you kind of wanted to stay back?
Yes, of course. And I think each person deals with that differently. I mean, if you want to get into the the psychology of Mike, I mean, it was like, I indicated that, you know, I kind of had like a cushy life. And there was, and when you have a cushy life, that's a reflection of like being very comfortable with being coddled. And when I was forced not to be coddled, I was like, I don't want to do this. No, I want, you know, it's in my mind, I don't want to do this. I liked it the way it was. I like this and that. But that being said, and I would say, and during the really intense times, there was hardly a day, maybe even not a moment in the day, like I didn't have that thought, like, you know, of I don't want to do this. But there was always a deeper knowing in me and of a trust. And, you know, some days that's more evident than other days, I suppose. But I always have had that trust. I've always had that trust. And so on a surface level, you know, maybe there's times it's more acute that I don't want to do this. And a lot of times, like stuff like this, like right now, like there's part of me that really does not want to go and share like my inner story, my inner workings for what have you. But then also this inner knowing of like, no, this is a story. This is, you know, this is for whatever reason. Like if there's one person who hears this and is like inspired to reexamine how they look at their experience, and then that pushes or encourages them one step further, then, you know, that's what it's about. So it's like, yeah, there's always this. And to me, this is a like competent learning competency of skill sets, of learning how to do this, of how to walk the journey, you know, the artistry of life.
That's a good name for a book, man.
I probably stole that from somewhere. I mean, it's you know, that's very much, I like to read all sorts of different things. And there was a time I read a whole bunch of what's generally referred to as Toltec wisdom. And that is a lot of this, like, you know, moving through the process of like becoming an artist of life and surrendering to life. And like, when you get to that level, like how life unfolds, and like, you read that and you're like, it sounds awesome and I want to do it. And then you learn how to do it. And it's probably very much like, as you describe, recovery. This is why I think, you know, that has not been part of my journey, but I'm pretty familiar with it. And this idea of like recognizing like at every moment, like, you know, all I know about is today. All I know about is this moment. Right now I'm not using. I can't make any promises about tomorrow, but I can promise about where I am right now. And that's a skill. That's a skill. That's learning a muscle. And that's a great model of like this process of recognizing the journey. Recognizing your life as a journey, and then like, okay, sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's easy. This is why the quarterback throws up. Tom Brady throws up before every football game. He's like, you know, the most accomplished quarterback in history. I love sports. I don't like fandom, but I love to see like any sort of excellence in like human physicality. And I do like the drama of competition, though. It's all friggin' like manipulative. Games are all controlled. That's another topic. But that being said, we can look at it mythologically, and just this idea of like, you know, each one of these contests of like, you know, if we look at football, is like, you know, the quarterback is the hero, and still like, you know, summoning up, like I'm nervous. It's like, it's hard for me to step forward, but this is my journey. This is my knowing, and this is what I prepared for. And that's my skills. And that's, you know, that's true for all of us. We're all the quarterback. We're all the hero. We're all this sort of stuff. And recognizing that within ourselves, but then it humbles us to recognize like it's not just me. It's like you're doing it and everyone's doing it. And then that's where like the compassion and the humility can come into it.
Absolutely. And I think when more people understand that everybody else is on their own journey, and kind of help them see their own kind of importantness in the evolution of consciousness on this planet, or the evolution of the species, like just by their own existence, that's freaking empowering, man.
It's empowering, and it gives you a great deal of compassion. like a detached compassion. It's like, I don't have to get sucked up in your drama, but I recognize your drama. You don't have to get sucked up in my drama. And it's knowing where someone is. And for me, this is just my approach, is like knowing how to meet someone where they are.
And that's like true empathy, right? Meeting someone they're at.
That's compassion. And like knowing when to back off and knowing when to be strong. And like, you know, that's the cool thing I think about, like so much of like practicing a lot of like these like Eastern practices of whether it's Tai Chi or Qigong or yoga, but of like really embodying like when you understand like what different forms represent, you're like, oh, I'm doing this in my body. My body becomes a symbol of it. And I'm embodying this energy of being strong, but flowing. And so that you know how to do that in every context, whether that's like working with a person, working with your own emotions. Really, I think it's probably best with working with it. I find it more helpful with work, with how I meet the outer world.
Yeah. I mean, I've used both concepts, like Taoism and Tai Chi, and all of those concepts are things that I personally use, and they're effective for both things for me. Right. Like the philosophy of Taoism is something that really helps me process the external world, because it allows me to recognize I'm not in control of most things. The only thing that I have some margin of control over is how I experience myself. And like that detached observation. But then Tai Chi, I use that to kind of like help ground me and function better in the external world. And I guess it also helps calm me internally. It's interesting how there's that reflective aspect of it.
That's what's so, in my opinion, that's what's so cool about a lot of those Eastern practices, is because it works on all of those levels, just as you describe, like your inner world and your outer world, and you don't even realize you're doing it, like by embodying certain flows. And like, I like the idea of like, once you get to a certain level of competency, then you create your own, because you have an understanding of the model, and then it becomes you know, when we call it something, like obviously there's a very specific form with like, you know, Tai Chi or with Qigong or with certain yoga practices. But when you understand it, you can move out of a dogmatic practice and then begin to do your own. And then you become like, you know, your own teacher, and you have your own flow with it.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of teachers, this brings me to the next question. Who is like one of your big mentors along the way? And if not a physical person, what was like one of the authors or something like that that really progressed you along your path?
That's a good question. All right, how do I want to answer this? So that's a deep question for me. And that's part of Mike's personal journey. And I've never, if I were to go and look at my like, you know, surface level material reality, like I never really had that. I never really had like that strong teacher role model. But then when you go and you look a little bit deeper, I'm like, well, yes, I did. I just didn't realize who these teachers were and what they were teaching. So I want to answer your question then, like a couple of examples. So this is what I think of is one of the most interesting teachers I've had. So I used to practice Aikido, and Aikido is like, you know, from like a lot of like real martial artists who want to go and like compete that way. Like Aikido is, to some of them, that's looked at as a joke, you know. Aikido kind of has like a weird reputation. But I approached Aikido very much as I was describing like the Qigong or anything like that. It's an embodying of a certain type of relationship with understanding energy on a deeper level. And it's a physical expression. And so I was thinking in my mind, I was approaching when I was studying Aikido, though where I was studying, I don't think anyone else had that approach. So I kind of like was internalizing it and thinking like, you know, I'm meeting all of the members at the dojo where they are, but I'm having my own sort of way, what I think I'm getting out of it. So all that being said, probably like 3 years into it. And, you know, it's horrible. Like, you see someone who's good at Aikido, it's the most beautiful thing to watch. But, like, you know, it's a hard, hard thing. And probably like 2 or 3 years into it, this guy just shows up in the dojo. He's kind of like a, kind of like this wanderer. And he was a little bit strange, at least, you know, to all of the other people in the dojo. And I thought he was like, I recognized like the words he was using and how he was approaching Aikido. I'm like, that dude, this is how I understand it and how I want to understand it. And he was very, very accomplished. He was, you know, at least in terms of like Aikido ranking, he was like higher ranking than the person who ran the dojo. And so me and this guy, like we developed and it was a short period of time, like we developed like a nice relationship. And he's like, hey, would you be interested in any sort of like one-on-one training? I'm like, hell yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking for. And this is falling, like this is naturally unfolding exactly in the fall, the autumn of 2012. So if you remember like what 2012 was like, the whole world was like all like hyped up on like Mayan end of the world sort of stuff. And I didn't have that perspective, but I definitely was aware of like, you know, what's going on and reading all of the, what was his name? Like John Major Jenkins, all of that sort of like literature. So I'm like, okay, this guy shows up in my life at this time and he's literally teaching what me from the perspective I've always wanted to go and learn. And so it turns out he's like, oh, I'm just kind of staying with my mom. I'm traveling through. He was about 10 years older than I was, maybe like 50 at the time. And he's like, I'm traveling through Lancaster and we can meet in the basement of her apartment. I'm like, you know, I'm thinking like I've got a foot in each side on both sides of the line. Like there's part of me which is really kind of drawn to this, but then there's also part of me because I've got a very trusting nature. Like I've gotten myself in situations because like I kind of go with the flow very easily. I'm like, you know, do I want to go into this like this basement or whatever? But it turns out that this apartment is about a half a mile from the house I live in. Like everything is like lining up perfectly. I'm like, all right, I'm surrendering to this. And then for the most part, we only trained together like maybe like 1 week for a 2 month period and definitely over the December time period. And he would more or less just have me stand on 1 foot and he would like kind of like push. He would like push me like on my shoulder here and like, you know, talk about me finding balance. He'd be like, try to lift up like, you know, keep your big toe down on the ground, but try to lift up the other toes and see if you can hold balance. Like, and I'm thinking, where am I going to learn stuff? And like, that's more or less all we did, things like that. And he used to say things to me and I part of me is like, I knew enough about NLP and like hypnotic programming. I'm like, this sounds a lot like, you know, triggering programs, but nonetheless, like, you know, I'm doing this and everything is kind of interesting and I don't know what's happening. So anyway, December ends, the guy moves away and really over the next year from that, my relationship with my physical body. I think most of us are not grounded in our physical body, particularly those of us that are extremely like, you know, air and water. Like we get really caught up in the mental, like, you know, I've always been like a good athlete, but I wasn't like really good. And I didn't realize until I got into my body, like I was just using my body wrong. You know, I was looking to do the wrong things. But the point I'm trying to make, and this was all about your question about teachers, was all of that began to show itself like a year later. You know, my relationship with Qigong changed immensely. My relationship with all like just movement, like how I carry my body, how I the muscles which I like literally use to walk, like, you know, which I never even thought about. Like what, one of these things this guy said to me, which always stuck with me, you know, he's like, this is the most basic Aikido movement. And he would say to a beginner that may have like three parts, you know, you go, and he's like, but to the master, there are 10,000 parts and he spent time in each one of them. It's all about like resolution. And it really got me to like, and that's being present. Like, you know, you have to go and like focus in. And I began to like look at everything like physically, like all of my movements and like how I hold my body. And I never never thought I held my body that poorly, though I did recognize in Aikido that I was horribly uncoordinated, and I never thought I was uncoordinated before. But all of that began to change within my body. And then as my relationship, like literally how I move in my body changed, everything began to ground. You know, I started seeing like things ground in within me. And this guy was like, you know, for a 2-month period, I would say he was probably, you know, as a teacher, particularly an esoteric teacher. And we never sat down and talked about esoteric thoughts. He just taught me how to stand on one foot and like that sort of stuff. And as they would say in the Eastern sort of practices, like he transferred like something to me just through like physical touch or being in his presence, what he learned from his teachers. And so that was a really, really big thing for me. And then I have like book teachers, and all of them are book teachers. Before I get into the book teachers, I want to give you like space if you want to have any questions about that or comments on that. And then I'll go to the book teachers.
I mean, the one thing I would say about that is I think that's very beautiful that you were able to sit and be present and still be mindful enough to like go through that experience. Cause a lot of people would completely shut down that experience when they're like, what the fuck is this guy trying to show me? But like just by showing up, he kind of planted that seed that germinated over the next year. And it was like being present with the mind, like bringing mindfulness to your actions and then how that permeates your whole experience as a result. That's really powerful, man.
Yeah. Well, it was a really cool time. Like I hold that, and every once in a while, I mean, and there've been a lot of like strange things, with these interactions with this guy, like, he used to smoke this like, grape flavored, what do they call them? Like the mini cigars, like the ones you'd get like at a convenience store. There would be a certain smell, and, I used to smell that all the time whenever like weird things would about to show themselves. I had a lot of strength since my time with him, and we could go into that if you're interested. Like I've had some really like what I would call life and death situations where I've emerged unscathed. And in my opinion, that is, I experienced the true Aikido. Like I might not know any of like the Aikido forms, but how I responded to life, what it gave me was, and it's happened multiple times, like true Aikido. So I have a great deal of gratitude towards this individual, and he continues to show up at these strange times. Like once I was meditating in my apartment and I was in a really like low level, and I was thinking about him, and I literally get this email from him. Like I hadn't heard from him in 4 years as I was thinking about him in this like emotional deep thing. And I write back, I'm like, who are you? Are you CIA? You know, maybe he was, I don't know. But like all of these sort of things were going on, and you begin to like, look at, this goes back to like being able to detach yourself from your journey and laugh at yourself and like see the beauty of it, the good fortune. I love seeing that in the background of your setting. But yeah, it was an unexplainable, and in the most literal sense, like I'd say magical sort of, interaction with that teacher.
Mm. Yeah. I'm curious about some of those experiences too, if you don't mind going into one or two real quick.
All right. I'll give you some quick stories, because I like to tell, make these stories drawn out because they're really cool. But one of them, a guy pulls a gun on me. Like the whole thing, like kind of, and it was right after I created this meditation. I used to do a lot of guided meditations. It was the first time I like spoke it out loud. This practice was all about facing fear. And so the way, like looking back at it, like in hindsight, like I literally just evoked that quality of like bringing in a situation where you get to face your fear, because the entire purpose of that meditation is about cultivating courage, you know, to face whatever it is like your fear may be. So I go and I speak it into existence, and like short, like literally minutes after I was done that, this buddy, and I knew he was coming by, like comes and picks me up, and we're going to go and walk to a friend of ours, birthday party. And during this walk is we have this like strange interaction with this strange individual who then goes and pulls a gun on me. I'm not, you know, I don't have a lot of gun pulled on me experiences. But my response was like the most basic Aikido sort of thing. And Aikido, particularly if you look at it from a physiological perspective, is you're rewiring your nervous system to not react, to respond with neutrality, and to meet whatever's coming at you. So like, I just went, whoa. And I put my hands up and I said it like as this guy's pulling this gun. And he literally just like froze in his tracks. Like not like, but just like became like something came over him and he just stopped and I walked away unscathed. And my, and I have a witness. Like if I didn't have a witness, I'd be like, yeah, whatever, Mike. But I had a witness. So that would be an example of like, that's true Aikido, what it's about. A second example, one of my favorite things to do. This is one of my favorite form. Like this is what I think is the highest form of Qigong for me personally. Is I love to ride my bike with no hands. Like I put on headphones. There's this one trail which I love to ride on, and like I block out all senses except for my eyes, and then like my higher senses, you know, because I can't hear anything, and I'm just And I'm riding and I'm getting immediate feedback because if I lose my center, I fall off my bike and I have to be aware of everything, but focused on nothing. And it's exhilarating to, I think there's nothing greater than riding a bike. And when you're riding no hands, your posture is correct, all this sort of good stuff. So I've been doing this for years and I've gotten pretty good at it. And I'm riding on this trail, which I always ride on, right along the river. And it's a pretty, it's a paved trail and it's a popular trail. And so I've gotten very accustomed. I have to take on full responsibility of my own safety and the safety of others because I'm taking on the risk. I'm the one without my hands on the steering, on the handlebars. I'm the one who's riding fast. So I'm very, very courteous. I'm very, very aware of all the other people and meeting them where they are. So I remember like riding up on these two kids, probably like 15 years old, 16, 17. And one's on a skateboard and one's carrying a skateboard. And I remember having a feeling. I just remember having a feeling like something's going on. Or like, not even a bad feeling, just a heightened feeling. And I remember saying, passing on your left. You know, that's what you do. You like, you announce yourself. I'm gonna pass it on your left. And next thing I remember, I'm standing on the trail, on the paved trail. It's like, I don't know, like 6 feet wide. And I've got my hands on my knees and I'm friggin' disoriented. I'm like, what? I'm just like standing there. And I look up and one of the kids is kind of like standing on top of me, like not physically, but he's like a foot in front of me and he's standing upright. And he's kind of, I remember he had like this like kind of like, shit eating grin on his face. And he's like kind of laughing. He's like, sorry, man. And like he and his friend take off. And I'm sitting there and I are standing there. My hands are on my knees. And what's going on in my mind is like, I just crashed into this guy. Like, you know what? And I'm taking on full responsibility. Like, you know, this is what because I'm riding with no hands. I'm going fast. And like the guy didn't know what to do. And I must've crashed into him and he felt bad cause I was on a bike or whatever. Like this is what I'm kind of thinking in this discombobulated state. And then I look at my arm and I see my arm is all bashed up. And then I look and I'm like, my knees are fine. And then I'm like, my hip is fine. And I'm like, I don't have any sort of like other wounds on me. I'm like, I'm standing here. I'm like, my bike is off on the side and these kids take away. And I'm like, I'm starting to come to my senses. And the only thing which I could logically, the only logical explanation is these kids, like, I don't know if you know what the knockout game is. The knockout game was this horrible thing, which was like popular with like stupid kids, like maybe like 10 years ago, where they'd like sucker punch someone and like try to knock them out. And so my sense is this was like a knockout game sort of thing. And when I passed him, this kid goes and he swings and hits me with his skateboard, the underside of his skateboard. And what I did, I don't remember any of this, is I've got no hands on the bike. My right arm just instinctively goes up. I deflect the hit and I jump off the bike and I land on my feet. Because if anything else happened, my knees would be banged up. If I landed on my hip, like I would have, I'd feel it on my hip, I'd feel it there. And I was thinking, like, that's the only thing that could have happened. But there was part of me, it's like, I don't remember that happening. Am I creating this story of Mike as Superman in my mind? But then, like, a year later, I had a conversation with someone else on who rides on the trail. And he told me the same story happened to him where these two kids on skateboards tried to attack him as he rode by in the same place. And so, like, I got this confirmation. And so I know that that's what happened, but that would be like true Aikido. Like somehow I knew what to do. Like my body responded in a way, and that would have really like effed me up. Like no hand, sucker punch, hit with the underside. My arm, I got pictures of my arm and hand. You could see the trucks underneath it, like how the scar, how the cuts were. That's true Aikido. And one last time I took a really, really nasty crash, once on my bike. And it was like, the backstory of that was it had to do with like, like someone who I used to be in a relationship with who like put a curse on me and like black roses and all this stuff. I'm like, I want to get rid of this stuff. And it was this beautiful day in February. I'm riding my bike and it was spring-like. And so like, it felt like spring. And I go into this tunnel. And I'm thinking it's spring, all the snow melted. And in this tunnel, it was a sheet of ice. And I hit this tunnel and this ice really fast. And I just went down. And I went down hard and somehow I knew how to fall and I fell in such a way that I got banged up on my hip, but I should have shattered some bones. I should have broken some. If you'd look at the bruising, which I had, I should have been much more hurt, but I wasn't. And it was because somehow I knew how to fall. I don't have the level of training where I should have been able to meet all three of those experiences the way I did, but I did. And so, you know, that would be an example. Those would be three examples of where I feel like, you know, that type of work has served me in life, in a way I couldn't control. And that's incredibly empowering because it frees yourself up of like, I got to know what to do, because you see that on a deeper level, you know how to respond, or, you know, if you want to say like people are out to protect you, you know, whatever it is, like beings are, you've got protection around you. I don't know what it is, but I've experienced it firsthand that, everything's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good thing for a lot of people to remember. I know that like, this is my own experience with everything's going to be okay. But a lot of times I have the same mindset of I have to consciously be in control of things or consciously putting in action to make things happen. But 9 times out of 10, if I actually get out of the way and allow whatever is out there to kind of control things, things tend to flow a lot better. And then you get those situations where you can kind of have miraculous things happen with no explanation because you don't have that moment of hesitation.
I mean, I would say that's very much like, you know, that's part of Mike's hero's journey. I mean, so that makes sense. And I think we all have whatever our obstacles, you know, not everyone's going to have like a physical obstacle, whatever they're working with, like, you know, they'll have that, they can witness that same level of surrendering to the flow and meeting it like, wow, I met that exactly. I couldn't have met that any better. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to avoid the difficult situations. I'm not going to avoid life. But then when you begin to go and see that there's a part of you that can, that responds to it in this beautiful way, it's, you know, you can't learn that in a book. You can only read so much about riding a bike, but you got to go out. Once you actually know how to ride a bike, it becomes something else. You know, it's
in, absolutely. In the Yeah, unless you're actually putting action behind something, it's just theory until you begin to cultivate the skills.
So we just talked, you just brought up theory. So I want to bring up like the other teachers. You mentioned teachers before, and I want to go back to non-physical teachers. And so like, you know, most people like in this particular age, you know, few of us get the opportunity to actually work with someone, and you know that you're in this like teacher student relationship. So, but the flip side of that is we have access to like books and information in a way that previous times did not, you know, so it always kind of balances out. So like book teachers for us are very, very important. And I can remember, like I indicated a little bit earlier in this conversation about how this time period really like maybe around like 2007 to 2012 was when I was feeding my mind with anything and everything which I can find from all of these different sort of perspectives. And whatever that was, like, you know, that built whatever framework internally that it did. But nowadays, you know, like more contemporary, like I can remember, like there were certain things which I've read, there were certain authors which I've read, which I remember as being influential and enjoying. But I'm not really that familiar. I don't remember what I liked about their books. I don't remember. Like, I just know that I did. So that being said, being in this current situation and being in this church, I have a lot of time to myself, and I don't read as much as I used to read. And so I'm like, all right, well, now's a good time to go and read. And I wanted to go back to some of these books which I know were influential to me, some of these teachers, these authors. And there are two books which, you know, I don't remember like which I read first. I don't remember like, you know, which the timing of the two, but I just remember that that they were both very meaningful for me. And one of those books, and I think I have them both right here. The first book was, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, is, can you read that? Psychological mm-hmm. Warfare and Secret Societies, and it's by Michael Hoffman. And this is really about, and it really taught me about, it really taught me in a very literal sense about mass occultic rituals and how they happen and like the psychology behind it. This book is brilliant in terms of explaining that and how mass subconscious or hidden esoteric rituals then affects us on a collective level and an individual level. And I remember when I read the book, my memory of reading the book was that it was very difficult reading. It was very dense. And like, I had to read it very, very slowly. And I needed to go and use a dictionary to go and like read words. So there's that book. And then this other book, which is in my history, is this one right here, which is Prometheus Rising by Robert Anton Wilson. And that book is very much, it's also talks a lot about like psychology, or at least the workings of consciousness, particularly the more like experiential consciousness, not necessarily like higher consciousness. And this book does a really good job of laying out like a model of how through just like the life experiences of like being a toddler, of going through, of learning to speak, and like, you know, as we step into sexual maturity, how the experiences that we had then create imprints within our neural circuitry, and then like, you know, how we become robots to it. And the book is ultimately about like recognizing that and breaking free. So these books are kind of similar, like in terms of like they talk a lot about psychology or the inner world, but they also are very, very different. And both authors are experts, like very, very knowledgeable about like conspiracy and like hidden hand and like secret societies and all this sort of stuff. So I remember this in my memory. Like I know that that's kind of what the books are about. And I remember that I got a lot out of them. So I started reading them both again about 30 days ago. And this time I'm reading them simultaneously. And the first thing I notice is how easy the reading is. Like I'm reading it and like the concepts are very, very familiar to me and I'm able to get something more from it. Like something which probably I did not get the first time around because I was just trying to understand initial concepts. And so the second time around, and then particularly with a chunk of time in between, I've got like a much greater, I've got wisdom. This is what happens with all of us. We get wisdom through experience. I have more wisdom than I did last time. And like, 7 years from now, I have more wisdom then, I wouldn't call myself wise. It's just like, we all are always gathering wisdom. And so I'm reading these things, these books, and I'm like, holy shit, these guys are using the exact same examples, and they're talking about the same people and the same organizations, and they're talking about them completely differently. Like one, like particularly Robert Anton Wilson, like he talks about like, every, like all of the alchemists of the Renaissance time period is, these are the those that have set the stage for us as humanity to expand our consciousness and no longer be prisoners of our own robotic thinking because we had these imprints of whatever happened in our life. And Robert Anton Wilson is very much a critic of like of culture, and like he's very funny and that, but his particular perspective is that the human being at the most basic level is like a very like sophisticated primate, and he says that throughout, we're just sophisticated primates. And we're, so then I'm reading the psychological warfare book, and the author is talking about the exact same people, and he's talking about them like in very diabolical terms and how sick and how they're being used to control the individual humanity or the individuals of humanity and the collective of humanity through all of these occultic rituals. And they're using the exact same scenarios. Like I would read like a chapter in one book and then I'd read a chapter in another book. And I'm like, they just use the exact same example. Like, that type of synchronicity. Oh, wow. But with Hoffman has this very different perspective. And he looks at humanity from this, like, we are a reflection of a creator, and by trying to control nature, we are interfering with, like, the creator's plan. And we're actually humanity, yes, we're reflections of the creator, but we're all like, we're our core is we're bad people, we're shitty. Versus like Robert Anton Wilson is like, no, we're all good, but we have like these robotic tendencies, and humanity has all this potentiality. And by reading them, so first of all, these guys are both like these teachers of me, like reading them, but then and how it's formed my understanding of reality. But now I'm going back and I'm looking at them side by side and I'm saying like, wow, this makes sense to me and I agree with this, but I don't agree with this. And this one here, I agree with this, but this doesn't, I don't necessarily agree with that. And like, I'm kind of like seeing how by reading from these teachers, like unconsciously, like, and me going through my own experience and the whole variety of life as a teacher, that I forged my own path. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true with all of us. And so like by reading these teachers of mine, side by side again, now you can then begin to realize how these teachers have impacted us, but then at the same time, not becoming echoes of a particular understanding, but like all they did was like they helped point us in ways where we can kind of understand, our own perspective of what this experience is, of what this hero journey is. And so like the teachers are different.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the awesome things about books. There's a couple things that I want to say on that. First off, it's always fascinating to me, and this is almost going to tie it back to some of the original things that we were talking about, like at the very beginning of the conversation, there's that whole quote by, I want to say it's Heraclitus. You can't step in the same river twice, or one man can't step in the same river twice. And so you can read the same book multiple times, but because your consciousness has changed between reading it and the information you've amassed is differently, you're going to interpret that information on a completely different level. And I think that that's one of the beautiful things about studying or about connecting with teachers through books is, first off, you filter all of what they're saying through your own experiences and your own wisdom. And then when you go back later, you're filtering it through yet again. And true knowledge isn't just being able to regurgitate the facts like they teach you in school. True knowledge is being able to assess that based upon your own experiences and that own filter that you've cultivated from your own individual experiences. Like, for example, when you read that 7 years ago, or whenever you read it last, you might not have had all those Aikido experiences, but now you're filtering that Aikido wisdom in there. And although it didn't come up in the conversation, like, you get different angles on that wisdom and it allows you to integrate it differently. And that's the beauty of it, right? Because then you share that wisdom with somebody else and it's filtered through your journey. And that's amazing.
Well, definitely. And this is the thing which I thought was, I didn't even mention this. What's so cool about reading the books, two different ideas of the same thing simultaneously. I mean, this is my experience. Like, I tend to I'm really good at getting fully ingratiated from something else. Like I can lose myself in someone else's ideas. I'm able to then withdraw from it also, but I can go and step in very much into another experience. And I know if I read a book, and particularly if it's a really well formulated and laid out idea, and the author is particularly insightful, you read it, that makes sense. You're reading it and you're like, yeah, this guy's got it. But when you read them simultaneously, and particularly with two guys who are really, really good at articulating, make valid points from two different perspectives, you can catch yourself. I caught myself of oh yeah, I would have probably not been so critical of this idea. If I would have read that one particular book straight through, and by doing those sort of things are very powerful, at least for me, in terms of using book teachers.
I think that's a good point though too. And I want to say that I saw a quote at some point where it said the sign of mature consciousness is the ability to hold multiple different or conflicting ideas. And it almost sounds like that's what you're talking about by reading those books, entertaining the different sides of the books, but seeing how it lines up with your personal experience.
And that quote is so close to the definition of what cognitive dissonance is. Someone who holds conflicting, simultaneous, paradoxical, or conflicting ideas. And the difference is one's awareness. Oh, I'm aware I'm holding conflicting ideas, and I don't realize I'm holding conflicting ideas. Because cognitive dissonance isn't something that serves us. We don't realize we're doing that. But when we can actually do that, that is I'm doing it at, I leveled up. I leveled up in terms of my awareness. I can see things from a higher level than before. And tying that into when I said riding my bike with no hands is the best form of Qigong for me, or my favorite form, the most enjoyable, is because it requires the embodiment of that. Literally, you have to be aware of everything, but if you focus on one thing, if your eye is looking on one thing, you're going to miss something else, and then you're going to fall off your bike and get all banged up, and you don't want to get all banged up. And so you are embodying this ability to be completely present, aware of everything, but holding on to nothing. And when you're doing that physically, it's not an idea. This is different than just sitting in meditation and saying that, and holding the image of the flower of life, which is a beautiful image, which will bring a balance into your inner world. But to actually do that in your physical body, that's how you ground it.
There's a couple things that I want to say on that. And then I'm probably going to have to see if we can reschedule the next part of this conversation, because there's still some questions I want to ask you, but I don't know that we have time.
All right.
Unfortunately. One of the things that I wanted to say on that is there's I forget who said this, but I saw a quote once and it talked about every book is a book on Tao, on the Tao, if you understand it correctly. And it almost is kind of what you're saying. Like the ultimate expression of Aikido is just this full presence. And that's almost the ultimate expression of life, is not being so hemmed up in how to do it, but showing up, but also in a conscious way. So like being, I don't even know how to express it. I think it's one of those things that goes back to, again, the beginning of the conversation or some point in the conversation where there's not actually words for it. So you have to rely on the symbols for it of being present, but not being sucked into. I don't know. I think you get what I'm trying to articulate, but I can't formulate it correctly. And then the other idea slipped my mind. So, I guess the last thing I want to say, and then I'll leave the floor open for you to kind of close this out and make any of your closing statements, is thanks so much, man. I always enjoy talking to you because you really illustrate lots of cool points, and our ideas are similar enough to where I get a lot from it, but the differences of how we approach it is enough too, where it's engaging and entertaining for me. So it's like super fun to have these kinds of conversations with you. So I appreciate you.
The feeling is mutual. You know, this is a fun format which we had, and I really appreciate the, you know, just like the opportunity to talk about some stuff I don't really talk about so much. And so it's thanks for having me on. And I guess like to kind of wrap this up, you know, and it's funny because like when we do this dance, you know, and when we have this conversation, like there is a degree of awareness that we know that we're doing this for an audience. You know, there's like, you know, this is infotainment in a way. There's a recognition of our stories and our perspectives of how that, you know, to anyone who's watching this, they're going to go and incorporate that in their perspective and like take in whatever makes sense to them or what have you. And like that's why I like to do these things is to do that as inspiration. But to that audience, to the person who's listening, like, I just want to reiterate, like, Now is unlike any other time in your lifetime. There is quite literally an integration which is being forced upon humanity. And that integration is just a reflection of a higher a time of integration. And so that time of integration is for those of us who are interested in inner journey and who recognize life is an inner journey. Like we have that opportunity right now to really, really apply everything which we've been working on. Like everything which you have done and seen has prepared you for right now. And now is the integration time period, whatever your technique is. So I want to encourage that. And by integration, that's like taking all of the different parts of who you are and like recognizing their order and their value and like who's running the show in your journey. And as we do that, like what's coming before us, like no matter how you look at it, life on Earth is going to be different in the future in a drastic way. And as we begin to recognize how much our inner world and our inner journey reflects the outer world, and particularly as it relates to flow, like this thing which is guiding us through this, that is going to really help in terms of the navigating, like, you know, what do I do? Because we don't know, we don't have a model to compare what's coming on or what's going to be unfolding before us. And it can be a lot of fun. And my experience, and I would say yours would as well, is that when you do become more integrated, which means you are more receptive to the flow of life and you see it more, that will carry us, you know, to at least through the storm. And hopefully in the creation of a much more harmonious expression, you know, this is what I hold inside, which is like a harmonious expression between like the human being, you know, our internal relationship with ourselves, our relationship with other human beings, and then most importantly, our relationship with how we interact with life and earth. I don't necessarily mean that in any way which has been experienced before. I mean this in understanding like rivers and trees and all of this stuff may have a bigger impact on the flow of life than we actually realize.
It's a very powerful way to close it out, man. I really appreciate that. Last thing that I actually want to ask you is, can you tell everybody where they can find you and check out some of your other work and stuff like that?
Yeah, definitely. I've been putting out a bunch of stuff on YouTube lately. I try to voice my language in such a way that I don't get censored. but I dance around a lot of these issues. So like, you know, what I think what I'm saying there, and there's a lot of good material, I think, that's out there. Susquehanna Alchemy on YouTube. It can be interpreted from a lot of perspectives, and I encourage that. Instagram, Susquehanna Alchemy, you could go there. If you're looking for something a little bit more, though, you could go to my website, Susquehanna Alchemy. What I've been doing lately is I call them starboard lights. I call this time period the worldwide initiation, and I've been doing a reflection of someone else's story back to themselves. Like, you know, I ask for their birth information. I have them fill out an intake form of like life experiences. And then we talk for an hour, and I just point out from another perspective, all of these different like correlations and recurring themes so that people can begin to look at their experience, from a different perspective than specifically how that ties into this worldwide initiation. So you could go to Susquehanna Alchemy and order a starboard light session. And then also that guided meditation I was talking about before, Facing Fear, the one with that is now available online as well. And that's friggin' awesome. I'd highly, highly recommend that to anyone. It's about 18 minutes. And I did it with this really talented person with sound. And so that's fantastic. And that's all about like creating the model inside of cultivating courage so that wherever that meets you in life, wherever you need to cultivate that courage, and that's different for everyone else, you know what to do, because this is definitely a time of cultivating courage. And then lastly, I've got a Subscribestar account, which is kind of like Patreon. And that's if you go to subscribestar.com, Susquehanna Alchemy, that's a way which you can support me if you're interested and capable of doing that. So, you know, I hope to see some people through those links.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Michael. I'll include them in the show notes so they have an easy gateway to all of them. And thanks for your time, brother.
Yeah, likewise.
Thank you for listening to the Spiritual Phoenix podcast. Please leave a kind review wherever you're able to, and like Spiritual Phoenix Studios on Facebook. Stay blessed.